2018. This is the Monday evening program. Our speaker is our brother Stephen Whitehouse, and the topic for this program is 1917, a miraculous year that brought about the state of Israel. Brother Stephen.
Good evening, everyone. So what we're going to do tonight is to look at a huge milestone and the purpose of God. We're going to look at the year 1917. But before we look at that, we're just going to provide a bit of an introduction to the importance of this year. So isn't it amazing that it's this particular year of the Bible school that the nation of Israel has celebrated its 70th year anniversary? This is the year, May the 14th, 2018. And that is incredibly significant, isn't it? It is so significant that the nation of Israel has celebrated its 70th anniversary. And when we look at this, we look at this picture here. This is David Ben-Gurion, and he's getting up and he's announcing to the world in 1948, on the 14th of May, he's announcing that the state of Israel has been established. And as we know, as Christadelphians, as disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ, this was a tremendous fulfillment of Bible prophecy. But we're going to look at another year. Another year in the plan of God, 1917. We're going to see that was a critical milestone in the establishment of the state of Israel and the return of the Jews back to the land as a witness that God, Almighty God, is the great creator, Yahweh. And in 1917, brothers and sisters and young people, it was a year that the world was at war. And we're going to just look at the context of this particular year tonight. And God willing, we're going to see that, yes, of course, we all recognize the importance of 1948. But we're going to also appreciate that 1917 was indeed a miraculous year. And I hope I can share that with you tonight, particularly the younger ones in the audience, that it was a miraculous year. So anyway, then, we've got this talk, and it's broken up into five parts. And let's just work through this. So first of all, then, we're going to look at a number of key individuals around this year, 1917. And 1917 is the year of the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration, and December of last year, the Balfour Declaration celebrated its centenary, its 100th year anniversary. And so this was critical in the establishment of the land of Israel. So we're going to look at the individuals involved in the development of the Balfour Declaration. So we're going to look at Lord Balfour, David Lloyd George, Churchill and Weizmann. You may have heard a number of those people before. Then we're going to share some research in the Rothschild archives. We'll come to that in a moment. And then we're going to consider the work of General Allenby and his march into Jerusalem. Then we're going to go forward a little bit in time and look at the ratification of the League of Nations in 1922. And then we're going to just reflect in our conclusion. December, the end of last year, the centenary celebrations of the Balfour Declaration and its importance and its significance. Okay, so it's a very simple structure. And hopefully you'll find it helpful, illuminating and excitational, because that's the point of tonight. So first of all, then, we're going to look at some of the individuals around the year 1917 that brought about the Balfour Declaration. And we're going to see that these members of the British cabinet all had a very interesting history and a good story to tell. So first of all, then, we have Lord Balfour himself, the Balfour Declaration. And we know that the Balfour family was, in fact, a religious family, and they read their Bibles every single day. So there was Bible reading within the Balfour family. It was also believed that Balfour, as a little boy, had a Christadelphian nanny. And this nanny gave him a copy as a young boy of Elpis Israel. We certainly know for a fact that Brother Robert Roberts contacted Lord Balfour in 1890 and gave him a copy of Nazareth Revisited. And where Lord Balfour died, C.C. Walker, the editor of the Christadelphian Office at the time, was invited to the funeral. Isn't that fascinating? Now we have David George. He was a Welshman. And his father died when he was two. Now, the importance of David George was that he was going to become the prime minister in the year 1917. So his father died when he was 2 years of age, and he was brought up by his mother and his uncle. And his uncle went by the name of Lloyd. And his uncle was a Methodist preacher. And in recognition of the work of his uncle, David George became David Lloyd George later on in life. Now, amazingly, we know concerning David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of 1917, that he even testified that he actually understood the kings of Israel before he knew the kings of England, which was a bit of a problem given that he was going to become the Prime Minister. Now, this is interesting. At the age of 14, he left school to practice law. And by the way, he became a much respected lay preacher in his local Welsh chapel. So a far cry from British politics today. So I want you to imagine this. David Lloyd George, he had no aspiration at the time to go into politics, and he becomes a lawyer. And he settles in a practice in Wales. And he is 14 years of age. Now, just listen to this. This is amazing. One of his first projects as a lawyer was to draw up a plan for a new client. And the new client was Theodore Herzl. Theodore Herzl contacted this little Welsh practice, had no idea that David Lloyd George would later become the Prime Minister. Theodore Herzl contacted him from Vienna, Austria. And the project, what was the project for a young David Lloyd George? The project was to develop a charter for a Jewish settlement. The first charter in almost 2,000 years. Isn't that staggering? In fact, Lloyd George presented this charter to the Foreign Office in 1903, while Balfour was the Prime Minister at the time. It would take another decade for Lloyd George to come together with Balfour, where Lloyd George would be Prime Minister and Balfour would be the Foreign Secretary that would bring about the Balfour Declaration later. But isn't that amazing that young David Lloyd George presented to Balfour in 10 Downing Street? It's also believed, having done a bit of research on this, that there's a brother, Joe Thomas from Nenethly Ecclesia in Wales, that served David Lloyd George at this time. Isn't that fascinating? These involvements of Christadelphian with these senior politicians. Now, if we look elsewhere within the cabinet, a number of cabinet members were believers in restoration theory. I don't know whether you know, young people, what restoration theory is. Restoration theory is all about a belief that the Jews will go back to the land before Jesus Christ returns, and they will convert to Christianity before Christ returns. This is restoration theory. And there are several leading politicians on the cabinet during the year of 1917 that actually subscribed to this theory. And to add to the number, there was also Winston Churchill. To everyone's surprise, in July 1917, Lloyd George appointed him to be the Minister of Munitions, and he joined the cabinet. To quote Lloyd George, he appointed Churchill for this reason, and for this reason only, to cheer me up when surrounded by gloomy faces. Much later, Churchill said to Dwight Eisenhower, the President of America, and these are interesting words, "I am, of course, a Zionist. And I have been ever since the Balfour Declaration." And what incredible role Winston Churchill would take during the First and the Second World War. Certainly a man very much raised by God for a particular purpose. And now we come to Dr. Chaim Weizmann. And he picked up where Theodore Herzl left off. He was a Jewish immigrant from Russia. I'm sure many of you know he was a brilliant scientist. He was appointed professor in chemistry at the University in Geneva in 1901, but because of the anti-Semitic feelings across Europe, he came to England. He couldn't actually find a job in London, and so he took up a post at Manchester University in 1904. In 1906, Balfour was busy campaigning for another term as Prime Minister, and he was in his election headquarters in Manchester Hotel. And he set aside 15 minutes to meet this man, Chaim Weizmann, a well-known professor at that time at Manchester University. And they were to meet for 50. I think I said United there. So they were to meet for 15 minutes, and actually they met for an hour, okay? At a hotel in Manchester, let me just be clear. When they met, Balfour asked Weizmann why the Zionists were bitterly opposed to the Ugandan offer. The offer of Uganda, or Kenya today, was in response to the terrible pogroms that were taking place in Russia. And the view was that Uganda would be a place of respite and refuge for the Jews. And history tells us that Weizmann was very angry with Balfour, who was prime minister at the time. And this is what Weizmann said to Balfour's question. And listen to this. And this, I think, captures really the spirit of Weizmann. If Moses had come into the Sixth Zionist Congress when it was adopting the resolution in favor of the commission of Uganda, he would surely have broken the tables once again. Years later, Weizmann wrote in his memoirs, so just recording the moment when he was speaking to Balfour, he says, I was sweating blood, and I was trying to find some less ponderous way of expressing myself. Suddenly, I said, Mr. Balfour, supposing I were to offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it? Fair question. He sat up, looked at me and said, but Dr. Weizmann, we have London. That is true, I said, but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh. He leaned back and continued to stare at me. I did not see him until 1914. So the seeds were planted. It was a view that was not accepted by those who were running for a general election at the time, but 10 years on, circumstances in Britain were very different. A war was being fought. And Kain Weizmann was found to be incredibly useful. So during the First World War, we've now moved forward 10 years. During the First World War, there was a major problem. Britain was quickly running out of acetone. And I'm sure you know, this was critical. It was a critical compound for gunpowder. It was imported from Germany, but given that the British Allies were fighting Germany, then that was unacceptable. And America were offering it at unacceptable rates. And so then Britain had to come up with her own solution. So the Prime Minister asked David Lloyd George asked Weizmann whether there was an alternative way of making acetone in large quantities. And Weizmann said yes. And there's no actual evidence that he had a theory at that time, but he said yes. And quite quickly, he invented a new process to reproduce acetone in huge quantities. It was a brilliant discovery. And it would change the course of the war, and by doing so, it changed the course of history. Now, everyone was delighted back home in Britain. Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, later in his war memoirs, records how he proposed to recommend Dr. Weizmann for some great honour. But Weizmann rejected the idea outright. He didn't want to receive any personal reward. So Lloyd George then appealed to him and asked, is there nothing we can do in recognition of your valuable work that you've done for this country? And Weizmann said these immortal words, yes, I would like to do something for my people, being a proud Jew. And so the British cabinet, the government there, they deliberated, and soon they came up with a decision, and it was the responsibility of Lord Mark Sykes on the screen here. He was the secretary of the war cabinet, and he cried the words, Dr. Weizmann, it's a boy, because there was a genuine sense that this had given birth to Israel's return to the land. Isn't that interesting? Now today, has anyone seen the Balfour Declaration in the flesh? Anyone? Well, today you can see the declaration. It's in the British Library in London. It's one long sentence. There's no punctuation there. It's 67 words. It's now just on a ragged piece of paper in storage. But it has cast a long shadow over the whole of the 20th century and now challenges for the 21st century. And we want to listen to the Balfour Declaration. What was written And who better to call upon now than Lord Jacob Rothschild? So Lord Jacob Rothschild is the great nephew of the recipient of the Balfour Declaration, who was Lord Walter. You can see there, Lord Rothschild, that was Lord Walter. And so we're going to call upon his great nephew to read out the Balfour Declaration to us. And I think you'll find this interesting.
His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment of Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people and renews their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing should be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours, Arthur Balfour.
And here it is, the Balfour Declaration. What do you feel when you see it here?
I genuinely feel it's one of the most extraordinary moments in the history of the Jewish people. If you think it took 3,000 years to get to this. And then you say, how did this miracle happen?
Indeed, how did this miracle happen that Lord Jacob has asked? Well, before we get to that, the question is, it's a reasonable question, isn't it? How had Weizmann influenced the British government and the country's elite in the year 1917? Well, what we do know, at the end of the First World War, he became a major celebrity. And even the young ones, I asked the young ones this morning if they had heard of Albert Einstein, and they said no. I'm sure they were just teasing me. But there he is, young ones. There's Albert Einstein. He became a personal friend of Weizmann, two brilliant Jews, and they travelled the world, and they were generating funds, actually, for a new political movement in Israel at the end of the First World War. So he became a major celebrity. In fact, Weizmann became the first president of Israel. So how was this achieved? Well, it's not obvious. That's all I can say. Weizmann was born in a little town in Russia called Motel. It was a place that was designated for the Jews during the terrible Russian pogroms. He was the third of 15 children, and he was the son of a timber merchant. So how could a man like this, who hardly could speak English, had no money, had no reputation, he lived in Manchester, away from London, he was not able to influence British government and the establishment. How could this be achieved through this man? It's quite incredible, isn't it? It defies probability. It's so unlikely. I ask you, did someone else help him along the way? Well, records tell us that there was help. Two men on the screen here, C.P. Scott and Harry Satcher from the Manchester Guardian. You may remember I just said about Weizmann being a professor at Manchester University, and he had a number of friends, benefactors there at the Manchester Guardian, and they offered a huge backing for him. But this is a story that is well told. If you look in your history books, you will find that the major support came from the Manchester Post. And I'm going to try and suggest that perhaps there was another influence, a greater influence than this. So to answer this question, we now go to the second section of our talk tonight, and we want to look at the Rothschild family and their family archives. Well, last year I wrote to the Rothschild family, and I wrote to the head archivist of the Rothschild family, Catherine Taylor. You can see a picture there, and she is personally handpicked by Lord Jacob Rothschild. Her job is to oversee all the archives of the Rothschild family. Now, to put this into context, the Rothschild family collectively own $1.2 trillion. And their history goes all the way back. They were supporting governments. They were the founders of Europe. And so I asked, could we come in and see their archives? Well, their archives are at Waddesdon. If anyone's been to Waddesdon Manor in England, it's at the Waddesdon Archive there at Windmill Hill in Buckinghamshire. And so when I went through the request, I had to explain who I was. And I explained I was a Christadelphian. I explained who the Christadelphians were, and how they have supported the Jews. And they were particularly interested to hear that the Jews were supported when they were founding the early parts in Palestine at the beginning of the last century. They were particularly interested that the Christadelphians were there, which they were, with brethren like Frank Janaway. They were there supporting the early movement of the Jews in their early settlement. And then I told her about this work that I was preparing, and she was really interested. In fact, she gave us a personal invitation. And so Sister Lindsay and myself and our three children went to handle the archives, but we didn't allow the children to hold them, much to their disappointment. Even now, they don't understand why they weren't allowed. Anyway, so we went through the private archives, the letters, and these letters were between the Rothschilds, Weizmann, Churchill, Balfour, David Lloyd George, Allenby, and many, many more. And what a privilege it was to go through these letters. And this is what we want to share tonight. Well, before we get into these letters, first of all, we need to remember that the recipient of the Balfour Declaration was Lord Walter. Lord Walter Rothschild, and this man was a total eccentric. He doesn't look like that except for his bowler hat, but he was a total eccentric. But surprisingly, he was converted by Weizmann to become a passionate Zionist at a time when his only great interest was to create the finest private collection of natural history specimens ever made by one man. These are his words. And he succeeded in doing so. So those of you who've been to England, you may have actually gone to the Natural History Museum in Tring, just north of London, and this is his museum. Of all the various things that he has discovered, he housed them there in this particular museum. But he was eccentric. Lord Walter never married, and he would ride around the park in a carriage led by his own zebras, or should I say zebras. And he was often seen sitting on top of one of his 144 giant tortoises that came from the Galapagos Islands. But nevertheless, there was a serious side to him. He was a renowned, brilliant scholar. He was a fellow of the Royal Society, which is no mean feat. He actually wrote 1,200 books and papers based upon his own collections. And soon he became the lay leader of the Jewish movement in Britain. So when the government decided to support Israel, he was the ideal candidate to speak to. And so this is why the Balfour Declaration was personally written to him. Now, while Walter, and this is the part of the story that I found most intriguing, I hope you do too. So whilst Walter, the recipient of the Balfour Declaration, was growing his own private collection, there was another Rothschild who was growing in prominence, a man called James. But Walter was on the English side of the family. James, or Jimmy to his friends, was on the French side of the family. Now, in 1913, Jimmy married a woman called Dorothy. It was a whirlwind engagement, and it only lasted 5.5 weeks. So actually a little longer than a Malatulin youth conference, but nevertheless, only 5.5 weeks. Dorothy wasn't even 18 years of age when she was married, and only then she had been allowed to sit with her parents in St. Albans at 7:45 every night to have dinner. So there was nothing in her past, her history, her experience that was going to prepare herself for a life with the most eminent bachelor in Britain at that time, Jimmy Rothschild. Now, James was 35 years of age. Dorothy was 17. So you can imagine, in high society, it raised a few eyebrows. But brothers and sisters, Providence was at work. In November 1914, when Dorothy was only 19 years of age, she heard Weizmann lecture on Zionism, and she was absolutely gripped. Her husband was away fighting in the French army in Paris, and so she was left at home to represent the family. She was in charge. So I want you to imagine this. A young Dorothy, she listens to this eminent professor speaking about Zionism, and Dorothy decides to speak to Weizmann at the end of the presentation. And she says these words: "You really need to meet my husband because he's able to help you. Now, Weizmann had no idea who this young woman was. He had no idea that she was married to Sir Lord Jimmy Rothschild. Had no idea at all. However, she went on to say, I first need you to be trained in British etiquette so that you make the right impression with my husband. Right? We are talking about the highest of society here. The personal friends of Jimmy were the cabinet, the royals, wealth right across Europe. And he was just a lowly, I should say, a professor. And she wanted to invite him into the circles of her influence. And that's exactly what she did, brothers and sisters and young people. It's very moving, actually. And she does this training in British etiquette with this Russian who spoke very little English at the time. And she does it in private without her husband knowing. Now, Sister Lindsay and I, we had the opportunity to go through these letters. And let me just tell you something here. We went through these personal letters and we discovered that Dorothy wrote to Weizmann no less than 33 times in training him in etiquette between 1914 and 1916. It is absolutely staggering. Dorothy helped Professor Weizmann organize no less than 2,000 personal meetings with the establishment in Britain. You think about that. 2,000 personal meetings. And she helped Weizmann write a further 1,000 letters. How industrious was that? It's incredible. And perhaps her involvement actually changed the course of the war. And so then, when they did meet, he was well trained in etiquette. And he had the impact that was needed. And Rothschild loved this man and ushered him into the influence of the government. And soon now, the government were listening to Professor Weizmann. Can you imagine that? Now, what's interesting, and this is a side point, we had to find that out by going through the letters because, and I'm not going to be disparaging because they've been very good to us as a family in allowing us to go through the archives, but what is clear, when you look at history books and when you speak to the Rothschild family, and I've got the greatest respect for them as a family, they will not mention Dorothy. And the reason being is that Dorothy was kind of plucked out of obscurity, and the establishment of Israel is to do with Walter and Jimmy. Can you see the point I'm making? We had to go through the letters to find the real influence here, the influence through Professor Weizmann. Isn't that fascinating? And surely, for me anyway, at least, and Sister Lindsay, you know that the key message for us was that God uses the so-called, the seeming small and insignificant. That's what he does. To show that he is God. And even in a war, when the world was gripped in fear, he's working with the small and insignificant to prove to the world that he is God and everything is in his control. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that wonderful? Well, we were certainly joyful as we came across this piece of information. So that's Dorothy. Don't forget about Dorothy. Don't forget about Dorothy. It's a lovely story. Now, we're going to share another little story here, which is not well known, about General Allenby. Now, you all know about Allenby. He walked into Jerusalem. Well, let's just think a little more about this man. Well, General Allenby was nicknamed the Bull because of his physical imposing presence. He was 6'2" and he had an impressive barrel chest. I'm glad he's not standing with me on the platform. But anyway, prior to the service in the Middle East, he's going to go to the Middle East, he's going to march into Jerusalem. But he was given charge of the Third Army and the cavalry on the Western Front. So he was the one who personally saw a million soldiers killed. It was a huge waste. And there was stalemate that was going on. In the Great War during that time, because none of the armies could get beyond the Western Front. And so this really then perplexed and exercised the minds of the British government. What were they going to do? Well, they sent for this man. They sent for Lord Balfour. They sent for General Allenby. And a bit of history on General Allenby. He has one child. He only had one child, Michael. And Michael... So we're going to get into a personal story here. Michael was enlisted at a very young age, at 17. And every single day, Allenby would go down to the office where war casualties were reported and inquire. These are the words that are recorded. He would say these words every single day. General Allenby, any news of my little boy today? So any parent in the room, we can empathise with that, can't we? His son was 17 on the Western Front, and Allenby would go down and he would be disguised. He didn't want any of the army, any of the soldiers to see him because he was leading the troops. But he was acutely concerned about his son. Any news about my little boy? And if his little boy was anything to do with Allenby, he was 6'2" with a barrel chest. But this is what his concern was. Now, the situation for Britain at that time was grim. And the Prime Minister later wrote in his memoirs, this is David Lloyd George, he says these words. Before Allenby left for Egypt, I had an interview with him and impressed on him that we wanted a determined attack and push against the Turks with the object of driving them out of Palestine. I said the cabinet expected Jerusalem before Christmas. Now, I know Brother Steve's going to talk about the drying up of the Euphrates from Revelation 16, so we won't talk about that. But this is a historical moment in time where the drying up of the Euphrates was taking place, the intention of the British armies to evict the Turks out of Jerusalem. And Allenby was told, as he was taken from the Western Front and placed in the Middle East, we need Jerusalem by Christmas, December 1917. Now why? Why was it that the British government, and remember the religious background of this government, why was it that the religious government wanted Jerusalem by the end of 1917? Well, again, this is interesting. Before Allenby left for the Middle East, he met with Admiral Lord Fisher, the first Sea Lord in London. So he was the one who oversaw the flotillas, all the ships that went to war. And this meeting was recorded by Lord Fisher's secretary. And this was what was said between the Lord Admiral, the one who was responsible for the sea and the navy. And this was the instruction that was given to Allenby before he left Britain to take up post in the Middle East. This is amazing. I've got it on the screen here. Let's just read this together. This is a memoir. Allenby was told that he would be God's instrument for the deliverance of Jerusalem in December 1917. So this is the Lord Admiral. This is the Lord of the sea and the merchants there. For the deliverance of Jerusalem in December 1917, stunned by Lord Fisher's words, Allenby asked him to explain the deduction. Admiral Lord Fisher, first Sea Lord, said these words. He spent several hours in discussing the Bible with General Allenby, showing him the prophecies that relate to the rise of Great Britain, and lastly, the prophecies relating to the deliverance of Jerusalem in December 1917. Armed and strengthened by his knowledge, General Allenby sailed for the Middle East. Did you know that? So before Allenby went into Jerusalem at the end of the year on December the 11th, we'll look at that in a moment, he was told that he was fulfilling Bible prophecy. Isn't that amazing? But Allenby went, and soon as he arrived in the Middle East, he received crushing news. Tragically, he was told that his son had died. His son was only 20 years of age. A piece of shrapnel had gone and pierced his helmet, and he died immediately. And this is the only record where soldiers record Allenby being reduced to public tears. But such was the measure of the man, he would continue in his work. And he asked the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, whether his wife could join him. And his wife came. And they continued the work together. And by December, they were in Jerusalem. Isn't that amazing? Absolutely tremendous how God has worked with these men and women here. Well, after a number of great victories, including the Battle of Beersheba, Jerusalem was next. And so then we arrive to December the 8th, 1917, just 3 days before Allenby is going to go into Jerusalem. And this is the first day of the Jewish feast of Hanukkah. But Allenby didn't want to fire on the Turkish troops in Jerusalem because he had so much respect for the city and the holy sites. And so then he contacts the Prime Minister for advice. But Lloyd George said that the War Cabinet was leaving to him and his better judgment. So that's what wasn't going to be helpful, was it? So not satisfied with that, Allenby then contacted the king and asked the king what he should do with the Turks in Jerusalem. You know what the king said? You need to pray about it, Allenby. And so he did. And so this is what happened. Allenby didn't want a fire to be shot. He wanted the Turks to simply surrender, so he commanded the Royal Flying Corps to drop leaflets all across Jerusalem informing the Turks that they needed to surrender. And this is exactly what happened. The Turks just retreated. The city was handed over to Allenby without a shot being fired. And so, as you can imagine then, Allenby's entrance into Jerusalem on December the 11th, 1917, was carefully choreographed. And the War Office in Britain gave careful instructions. Look at this. This is the telegram that Allenby received before he went into Jerusalem from the British government. And it says these words. In the event of Jerusalem being occupied, it would be of considerable political import, Allenby, if you, unofficially entering the city, dismount at the city gate and enter on foot. The German emperor rode in, and the saying went round, a better man than he walked. Advantage of contrast in conduct will be obvious. So then, Allenby complied, he dismounted his horse, and he entered into the Jaffa gates. And he was followed in by this man, Bert Pepin. Bert Pepin walked through the Jaffa gates with Allenby. And he would later become Brother Bert Pepin of Taunton Ecclesia in England and the recording brother of that ecclesia for many years. And I've spoken to his family. And he walked through the Jaffa gates with Allenby and he could see the Turks just removed. And he could see that this had nothing to do, that was his belief, it had nothing to do with the British government or the propaganda or the leaflets, that something greater, a greater power, was at force that day. And so then, Pepin resolved that he would go home, he'd read his Bible and find the truth, and he found the Christadelphians. It wasn't a leaflet that found him, he found the Christadelphians. And he married Sister Elsie, and they had two daughters, and this is a rare sunny day in England. And they're enjoying a lovely afternoon together. What a lovely story. In fact, I was actually giving a talk on the sixth day, on the drying up of the Euphrates for a fraternity in Ecclesia. And they told me that the recording brother of that Ecclesia was Brother Bert Pepin. You imagine how delighted I was to find out about that. I didn't know about this story until his family told me. And I told the Christadelphian office, and we published a little article about it. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing how God works? Well, let's just see how Allenby marched into Jerusalem. I'm going to show you some old footage here.
General Edmund Allenby's army swept aside the Turkish forces and conquered Palestine. Yet this was, despite appearances, no simple triumph of an invading army. So it was that Allenby was ordered by London to enter the city on foot without flying any flags. He appeared to onlookers more as a humble pilgrim than a conqueror. And remarkably, the local people were asked to believe that Allenby's arrival in the city had been prophesied. The British propagandists realized that almost miraculously, Allenby's name, when written in Arabic, spelled Al-Nebi, that is, the prophet. And that was how the British presented a Christian general to the Muslim population of the city. Allenby was, as prophesied, their saviour.
So, in the Christadelphian magazine following the Balfour Declaration, Brother John Carter included a letter written by L.G. Sargent to the London Daily Telegraph. So I'm just going to read this letter that was written by the editor at the time to the London Daily Telegraph after the Balfour Declaration was issued. And I'm sure you've never seen a letter quite like this before. It was in the year 606 BC that Nebuchadnezzar first came against Judah and carried Daniel and the Hebrew children, among others, captive. At this time, he was acting on behalf of his father, and it was not until nearly 2 years later, in 604 BC, that he himself acceded the throne. That year is consequently, properly speaking, the first of Nebuchadnezzar, and it was probably also the year in which he saw the vision of the great image, in connection with which it was said to him, "Thou art this head of gold." This year has therefore some special claims to be considered as a very principal starting point of the times of the Gentiles. Measured from it, the period runs out in AD 1917. Isn't that amazing? It was an incredible letter, and it's such a shame that the Daily Telegraph chose not to publish it. We want to consider now that the League of Nations in 1922, because you might not know this, because I think the story of the Balfour Declaration tends to conclude where we've just left off. But we'll just go forward now 5 years. So just 5 years then after the Balfour Declaration, everything actually in Britain hung in the balance, because there was growing international pressure for Britain to stand aside from Israel. In fact, on June the 21st, 1922, just 5 years after the declaration was issued, the House of Lords debated Britain's support of the Mandate of Palestine. Not the House of Parliament, the House of Lords. The motion to abandon the Balfour Declaration was actually passed in 1922. I don't know if you know that. Did you know that? It was passed by 60 to 29 votes. So after all that work, Britain was about to walk away from the declaration, and everything looked incredibly bleak. And so it fell to one man, Winston Churchill, to answer this motion in the House of Commons. As the saying goes, cometh the hour, cometh the man. His speech was powerful, it was long, it was appealing to his countrymen. He said words such as, "A Jewish national home in Palestine should be internationally guaranteed." And then he goes on to say, "And formally recognized to rest upon its ancient historic connection." It was a moving speech, and it required all of his abilities. And at the end, the Commons supported the Balfour Declaration. 292 votes for, and 35 votes against. It was a persuasive speech. It swung the opinion of Parliament, but of course God was behind it all. And so then we have the League of Nations. And so it was submitted to the League of Nations on the 24th of July, 1922, following this extraordinary speech of Winston Churchill in the House of Commons. And it was approved. It was ratified. The Balfour Declaration then became official. It became international law. So then we should ask ourselves the question, if we look back with the benefit of hindsight, what is the historical significance and importance of the Balfour Declaration? What difference did it really make, if anything? Now, I'm going to call upon Lord Rothschild again. He's very busy tonight. I'm going to call upon him again to answer this question. The significance of the Balfour Declaration. You may know a number of these panellists.
And the most difficult one, the importance of the declaration to the state of Israel. Surely one can start off by saying it was the foundation stone of the state. And you said in your excellent book, The Long Shadow, The Great War in the 20th Century, that the declaration itself was two-sided. It was a moral commitment, but an ambiguous one, to Jews and Arabs. It had no legal standing. The public act of recognition to Zionism was to be formalized after Churchill presented to Parliament the Churchill White Paper in 1922. which was emphatic in its support of Zionism. That paper was submitted to the League of Nations in Geneva and approved. And as Weizmann put it, it represented the Magna Carta of liberation, a decisive event in Jewish history. And it gave Zionism the legal right to move towards statehood. And that in turn led to the establishment of the State of Israel following the United Nations resolution of 1947. So after 2,000 years of persecution, the Jews were at last to return home. And as the poet touchingly, Robert Frost, wrote in The Death of the Hired Man, home is the place where, when you go there, they have to take you in. And every Jew in the world has the right of return to live in Israel.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that the opening words there of Lord Rothschild were these words: the declaration was the foundation stone of the State of Israel in the year 1917. So he couldn't be any clearer, could he? It's moving to think that at the end of Balfour's life, on his deathbed, Weizmann was the only friend admitted to see him. Mrs. Dugdale, Balfour's niece and biographer, wrote these words when Weizmann goes in to see Balfour one last time. Let me read these words to you. Again, they're very poignant words. She says, "No words were said between them, for Balfour was very weak and Dr. Weizmann much overcome. Balfour moved his head and touched the bowed head of his visitor. In the silence of the room, the bond between them could be felt." Two great men, raised in a particular time for a very special purpose. Well, way back in 1849, Brother John Thomas wrote Elpis Israel. And it's quite staggering that he wrote these words, which we're going to share in a moment, concerning the course of Britain 70 years before the Balfour Declaration was issued. Now, this man was not inspired, but because of his careful and meticulous reading and understanding of God's word, these are the conclusions he came to. He says these words in 1849, "I know not whether the men who at present contrive the foreign policy of Britain entertain the idea of assuming the sovereignty of the Holy Land," which would take place in 1917, "that the finger of God has indicated a course to be pursued by Britain which cannot be evaded, and which her counsellors will not only be willing, but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them." And that's exactly what happened, as we've seen tonight. So what about then these centenary celebrations in our final section? As we think back in December of last year, what was happening in Israel? What was happening in Britain? Well, on the day of the anniversary, on December the 11th, 2017, there was a special anniversary, and Benjamin Netanyahu flew into London, the Israel Prime Minister, to be with Mrs. May. And you can see they're viewing the Balfour Declaration, and Lord Jacob there is on the right-hand side. And that evening, Mrs. May hosted a dinner at Lancaster House, and these were the words that she not only issued to the Israeli government, but to the press, to the world. And just listen to these words.
"Let us cast our minds back to the time of 1917. In an era of competing imperial powers, and with Britain still embroiled in the midst of the First World War, the idea of establishing a homeland for the Jewish people would have seemed a distant dream for many and been fiercely opposed by others. Yet it was at this very moment that Lord Balfour had the vision and the leadership to make this profound statement about restoring a persecuted people to a safe and secure homeland. And third, this was a letter that remains very sensitive for many people today. But it was not ignorant of those sensitivities. Indeed, Balfour wrote explicitly that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So when some people suggest we should apologise for this letter, I say absolutely not. We are proud of our pioneering role in the creation of the State of Israel. We are proud to stand here today, together with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and declare our support for Israel. And we are proud of the relationship we have built with Israel. And as we mark 100 years since Balfour, we look forward to taking that relationship even further.
So you can see there that she was emphatic in her support and Britain's support of Israel just last December. So then, in conclusion, we have seen that the Balfour Declaration was indeed the foundation stone of the State of Israel, just the words of Lord Jacob Rothschild himself. And it's interesting as we reflect upon the last 12 months that it has been a year of anniversaries, hasn't it? We thought about December of last year, 100 years of the Balfour Declaration. You can see on the screen, 70 years of the State of Israel. And I was there just 2 months ago. And it's extraordinary. I don't know how recently anyone has been in Israel. Israel is covered as a land with cranes. Cranes are everywhere. Roads are being built and constructed. There is now a monorail that connects Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. And I couldn't understand why. Why all this new infrastructure? And so then I was going around with a rabbi and I asked the rabbi, why all this investment? Do you know what the answer was? We are building for Messiah. There is a heightened expectation within the land. And just last year, June of last year, we have the 50th year anniversary of the Six-Day War. Three huge anniversaries we've seen during the course of the last 12 months. So I'm just going to leave this with you and then just a few reflections and we'll conclude. We haven't looked at David Ben-Gurion, who proudly stood up and announced to the world that the State of Israel had been established. And I want to show you this rare footage. And you get a sense of excitement within the land. And you may even notice a picture, an oil painting behind David Ben-Gurion. And you'll notice that that is a painting of Theodore Herzl, the very man who contacted David Lloyd George for a plan for establishment of God's people within the land. Look at this rare footage here.
On May 14, 1948, the British government terminated its Palestine mandate, and on May 15, 1948, David Ben-Gurion declared the independent state of Israel.
So I'll leave you with these thoughts as we reflect then, as a community, on the 70th anniversary of the State of Israel. As we look back and we think and we reflect upon the centenary anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, I encourage you not to forget Balfour, Lloyd George, Weizmann, Churchill, Allenby, the Rothschild family, and young Dorothy in the purpose of God. But most importantly, in all these moments that we shared with you this night, in all these incredibly providential moments, we see God. We see the God of Israel at work. And he is bringing about the people within the land so that he could send his son soon to establish God's kingdom. The Lord God declares in the scriptures, young people, that his land and his people are a living witness that he is the living God. We are living in truly momentous times. We pray for the peace of Jerusalem.